First, I recently confirmed that on numerous occasions, the intelligence community incidentally collected information about U.S. citizens involved in the Trump transition. Details about U.S. persons associated with the incoming administration, details with little or no apparent foreign intelligence value, were widely disseminated in intelligence community reporting.
California Republican Devin Nunes, during a press conference yesterday, his claim that members of President Trump's transition team were caught up in routine legal surveillance by the intelligence community was treated as both bombshell and head-scratcher. Bombshell because Nunes seemed to be saying that President Trump was correct when he tweeted that the Obama administration had spied on him. Head-scratcher because Nunes offered no evidence to support that claim, and he talked to the White House and the press before briefing his colleagues on the House Intelligence Committee, which he chairs. Today, he apologized for that, but for fellow Intelligence Committee member Adam Schiff, it's not quite enough.
The chairman will need to decide whether he is the chairman of an independent investigation into conduct, which includes allegations of potential coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians, or he is going to act as a surrogate of the White House because he cannot do both. And unfortunately, I think the actions of today throw great doubt into the ability of both the chairman and the committee to conduct the investigation the way it ought to be conducted.
Schiff and Nunes, two California lawmakers, have become the public faces of the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. For more on that tension, we're joined now by Sarah Weyer. She covers California's congressional delegation for the LA Times. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so their relationship seemed to come to a head yesterday. Nunes has come under a lot of fire from Democrats, and Schiff especially going after him. What does this say to you? They seem to be at opposite ends of this. Is this characteristic of their relationship?
It's really not. They've worked together really closely for about the last 10 years and on the committee itself for the last two as leading it. These are guys on a committee that, you know, normally works behind closed doors, is not seen as partisan. You know, they've bonded over things like the Oakland Raiders and their mutual love for them. So to see them on opposite sides of an issue like this was kind of a surprise for everyone up here in Washington.
Well, let's talk a little bit about both of them and how they got this far and why they're now in the limelight. And let's start with Adam Schiff. Until now, he pretty much flew under the radar when it came to press attention. Now he's, you know, he's on TV constantly. He's on the radio. He's everywhere.
That's right. I've noticed that as well. I actually have a story coming out on that this week. But he, his background, he was a federal prosecutor, and he actually successfully prosecuted the first case of an FBI agent convicted of espionage back in 1991. And he, you know, has kind of flown under the radar since he came to Congress in 2001, but he has really started to make a name for himself in national politics or national security and foreign affairs.
And where does he stand on that? Because I know he voted for the Iraq War.
I would call him moderate and thoughtful. I think he's not the kind of guy who just jumps on a party line because it's there.
So why do you think that he is taking such a public role in this? Why does he see this as his fight and such a public fight?
I think he sees it as the role of legislators to, really act as that oversight of the agencies. I mean, this is the House Intelligence Committee is tasked with overseeing all of the intelligence agencies, and he takes his work very seriously. He spends the majority of his time in the windowless classified room under the Capitol reviewing these documents.
And so he gave a pretty long, I think a 15-minute long opening statement on Monday when Comey was testifying, the FBI Director James Comey was testifying, where he laid out all of the allegations against the Trump campaign and in this Russia story. So what did that say to you in terms of what kind of information he has, whether or not there was collusion?
It was quite interesting because everything he laid out was already in the public record. And he is very careful to not say anything that is classified, not public yet. But he said since that he has seen evidence that goes beyond what is out there that there could be collusion. I haven't spoken about that with him personally myself, but he has been on cable news this morning talking about that.
And let's turn to Devin Nunes. What is he saying about that? It seems he's trying to take the opposite tack, that there doesn't seem to be evidence of collusion so far.
No, and that has really been his perspective since talk of an investigation first began. He's really kind of put a kibosh on any discussion of a independent commission, saying that what the committee is doing is going to be sufficient. He didn't really jump to support any candidate until Trump became the nominee, but he wasn't one of those outwardly vocal supporters. But he was a member of Trump's transition team and helped the team make decisions on appointments. And that's something that a lot of people are starting to focus on now, is whether it's appropriate for someone who was involved in the transition to be in charge of the investigation. I think I've heard several members of Congress mention that in the last few days.
What has been his stance on Russia until now?
He is not someone who thinks that it can become an ally. He doesn't tend to believe this idea of a reset is possible. The committee had been investigating Russia and cyber attacks for over a year, and he had been warning that they were, using hacking and things like that to play a role in American society as far back as last February. So he's not someone who's okay with the idea of becoming friendly with Putin.
So this guy also has flown under the radar for many years and seems to be only reluctantly in the spotlight now. He's a dairy farmer, and I think he was quoted once as saying that was his life's ambition, to be a dairy farmer. And yet here he is at the center of this story. How does that sit with him?
It's been interesting watching him kind of come to terms with what his role is. I mean, it's something I think we're going to really have to watch in the next few weeks and months to see how that progresses.
So it's interesting. The two of them have pretty similar temperaments outwardly.
Yes. They are both rather soft-spoken. I've never really heard either of them raise their voice too loudly. They're both very funny guys, though. Adam Schiff can really tell a joke.
And they get along, as you say, when they're not in the spotlight.
Yeah, they seem to get along. They can really compartmentalize the fact that they both represent different parties, they represent different constituencies, but they've got a common goal most of the time.
Sarah Weier covers the California Congressional Delegation for the LA Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the story about possible collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians is scrambling traditional political lines when it comes to surveillance and the NSA. And here to talk about that is our regular web and tech guru, Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hello.
Hi, Madeline. Oh, the world is weird and it's just getting weird.
Everything is topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
So we know that this investigation is ongoing in various quarters in Washington, but what we do know is that it is perfectly legal under FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, mm-hmm. to pick up phone calls with foreign entities, correct?
Yes. So after 9/11, we all remember that there was this sort of gradual shift of our government and of our laws to allow our intelligence agencies to gather more signals. The idea was that the more intelligence we gather, the more intercepts, the more our government would be able to sniff out a possible threat. Well, one of the ways that that our country did that in 2008, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, as you'll hear law nerds talk about it as FISA, mm-hmm. Section 702 allows the National Security Agency, allows the U.S. to listen in on communication involving foreign nationals that are here in the U.S. So let's say that you, Madeline, are the Russian ambassador, and I am communicating with you regularly about a really cool, oil deal that we want to strike together in Kazakhstan when all this political stuff is over. Well, you, as the Russian ambassador, it's actually to the letter of the law. It's a completely understandable and normal thing that the NSA might be listening to what you're up to. Mm-hmm. You're an agent of a foreign government.
So therefore,
here in the US.
You're listening to...
So if the NSA is listening to you, Russian ambassador, and I'm talking to you, well, they're going to listen in to me as well.
But do they know who is on the other end of the call, who the American is, or is it just coded?
I don't have enough security clearance to answer that with authority, but look, this is all relatively new, right? So the precedents for how our institutions handle this, it's still developing. We first found out about this kind of dragnet surveillance. Remember when Edward Snowden leaked all those PRISM documents from the NSA? Everybody was freaking out because we learned that, yes, the NSA gathers almost like if you're fishing in the ocean and you use a giant net and you're just trawling and you catch whatever you catch. Well, you know, you might catch a dolphin in there too, right?
Yeah.
So the concern after the Snowden leak was, you know, I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm just minding my own business. I'm not even talking to the Russian ambassador about a deal in Kazakhstan. Why should I be potentially caught up in that? And the weirdest thing happened. Instead of just us lefty, libertarian, cypherpunk, you know, free Julian Assange, Edward Snowden flag waving types being concerned about privacy, being concerned about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, suddenly, the rightest of the right is flipping out because some of their own, somehow, it certainly seems that some of the communication involving these individuals was caught up as America's intelligence machine was keeping an eye on these foreign nationals within our borders. So suddenly to have Donald Trump being the person who's arguing the loudest against FISA courts and warrantless wiretapping, you know, to quote Zoolander, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills every day.
Right. And it's on the opposite as well. Right. So the Democrats are saying, Yes. Well, we need these. We need to keep an eye on what's happening. So we do need to have surveillance.
There was a hearing on Capitol Hill. There was a McClatchy report that I was reading on March 1st. Ted Lieu, another California lawmaker, was among the kind of pro-privacy civil liberties types who was raising questions about whether Section 702 should be renewed when it expires at the end of this year, December 31st, Section 702, which allows for this mass kind of dragnet surveillance that may pick up signals of Americans.
But even without Section 702, the Russian ambassador would be surveilled.
I think that's reasonable.
Just what happens.
I think that's reasonable. I think that very few people, even in my technology community, would say that we don't have a right to keep tabs on people who work for foreign governments, adversaries, when they're in the United States.
Section 702, though, was about foreigners who are not on our soil, who are elsewhere, phone calls, internet communications, what have you, being made to people here in the United States?
Yes, and also foreign nationals who are here.
Yeah.
So it's the laws are one thing on paper, and they're another thing in the courts, and they're another thing in real life. And one of the strange things about technology policy is that, by definition, you're trying to craft laws and predict the way a technology is going to play out in real life. No one could have predicted this. I certainly didn't predict that the staunchest opponents of NSA surveillance would be GOP politicians that were maybe caught up in something dirty. I mean, we will find out.
So do you think that they will let, the Republicans will let this expire at the end of the year?
I don't know. It would certainly be very, very weird. You know, that hearing that I mentioned at the beginning of this month, the Republicans who were part of that hearing, some of them, I was reading the transcripts just this morning, were sort of deferential towards their Democratic colleagues saying, well, I know you guys aren't really into this NSA surveillance stuff, and we're going to try to respect your opinion. Boy, a lot can change on Capitol Hill in 3 weeks.
Suddenly everyone's cooperating.
There are a few things that are in play right now regarding FISA, regarding Section 702, regarding all of this NSA spying. Will this be renewed at the end of the year when it expires? Expires every 5 years. We either renew it or we don't. And secondly, should American law tighten up what information can be collected that involves Americans? Should we have greater safeguards in place that determine what happens with that information when it is collected? If we want to prevent this kind of surveillance data from being used as a political tool, maybe there are ways that the laws should be refined. It's through tests like this in the real world that we learn the strengths and the weaknesses of the letter of the law. There's no, it's very messy, but I feel like this is the only way for us as a nation to figure it out.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net and our regular web and tech commentator. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up on the program, children in some parts of Los Angeles have lead poisoning rates equal to or worse than Flint, Michigan. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. High levels of lead in Flint, Michigan's drinking water made headlines last year, but in some areas of California, the lead problem is a lot worse. In one Fresno neighborhood, there are three times as many children with high levels of lead in their blood than in Flint. Children in South LA, the San Gabriel Valley, and in downtown Los Angeles also had high lead levels. Josh Scher and Michael Pell investigated this story for Reuters, and they both join us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Well, Michael, let's begin with you. Tell us about the lead testing data you found. Where did it come from, and what was the most surprising aspect of it?
Well, we obtained this data from the California Department of Public Health, and it was a month-long process back and forth with them to try to get them to release this information. And I think that the most surprising thing for us was that how many kids do have been exposed to lead in the state of California, which is much newer than some of the states that you would typically think of when you think of lead poisoning.
Yeah, you wouldn't think of California, which prides itself on its environmental awareness.
So, and rightfully so.
Yeah, and so what are the numbers?
Well, what we found were 29 zip codes across the state where the rate of elevated lead levels was at least as high among tested children was at least as high as the rate in Flint, Michigan during the peak of that city's crisis.
29 zip codes, and in what areas of the state?
They range from all over the state, from Humboldt County in the north to the Bay Area, Alameda County, to as you said, Fresno, Kern County, Kings County, El Dorado, and Los Angeles.
Josh, let's turn to you and let's talk about the levels of lead in the blood. Officials say there's no level that's safe, correct?
That's right. No level of lead in the blood has been determined as safe. Now, the CDC uses a level of 5 micrograms per deciliter, which they call an elevated level, and they say that any child that tests at that level or above warrants a public health response.
What has been the public health response in California?
Well, California has a statewide lead poisoning prevention program, and many counties and cities, including Los Angeles, have their own programs that work with the state program. Now, California sends out an environmental inspector or a nurse to attend families when a child tests at 14.5 micrograms per deciliter or above. That's about three times the level that the CDC considers elevated. But also, they do attend families whose children test at a 5, the elevated level, and in those cases, they sometimes provide educational material, follow-up testing, that type of thing. Now, universal testing is not required in California. There is a bill, however, that was introduced by an assemblyman recently, Bill Quirk, which would require testing for all children in California.
Is it required in other states?
In some states. 11 or 12 states have a universal testing requirement, but the majority has, like California, what they call a targeted testing protocol, and that means they try to identify the children that would be at highest risk to test. Those might include children who are enrolled in Medicaid for low-income families, as well as children who live in older housing, like pre-1978 housing. 1978 was the year that lead paint was banned.
So where is this lead coming from?
Well, you know, the blood lead level tests don't tell you the source of exposure. They simply tell you that a child has been exposed to high levels of lead. But the experts we've spoken with and the public health officials say that a primary risk in California is from old or peeling, crumbling paint in older housing and properties. Other risks include contaminated soil in play areas, and certainly like in Flint, there have been some concerns with water delivery systems and older plumbing that may contain lead. But that isn't necessarily the primary concern, and lead paint is perhaps the primary concern.
So that's when children put it in their mouths or they breathe in some of the dust from the peeling paint?
That's right. You know, one and two-year-olds often are crawling around. They're just learning to walk. They have hand-to-mouth behavior, and they may be exposed to dust or paint chips or peeling paint in older housing. That is a risk.
And, Michael, you're saying it was difficult to get information from the California Department of Public Health. Are you waiting on more information?
We would still like more information from the California Department of Public Health. They provided us a snapshot of data from about 25% of the zip codes in the state. They provided us this data for 1 year, 2012. We would like them to make more data available to the public so that way the public can make more informed decisions about health programs and how they want to fund them and how big of a risk lead is in their communities.
So what was you did you try to interview them? What was their response to your story and what you uncovered?
Well, their response to the story was they don't think that a comparison with Flint is necessarily fair. And the reason is because they say, oh, well, we take this targeted approach to testing, and so we find a higher percentage of kids with elevated blood lead levels because we're trying to find them. The problem with that, though, is that as we reported last year in another story, we know that they don't do a great job of testing kids that are considered at high risk. For example, kids that are enrolled in Medicaid. They're only testing a fraction of these kids.
And why not? Why aren't they testing all of them?
Well, they're required to test all Medicaid-enrolled children at ages 1 and 2. When we asked them about this, they said, we need to do a better job.
And is that a federal law or is that a state requirement under Medi-Cal?
That is a federal regulation.
So all children who receive Medicaid should be tested for lead?
At ages 1 and 2,
right.
Yes.
And that's just not being done in California?
It's not being done in California, but in all fairness, it's not being done in a lot of states.
And that's because it's costly?
Well, no, it's not necessarily that it's costly. There are a number of reasons that it's not being done. Some doctors just don't think it's important. There's no emphasis on testing lead because it's thought to be the problem of certain children. Sometimes the doctors don't know about a family's risks. They don't know that they're living in older housing. They don't know that maybe the grandparents live in older housing. They don't know that the father works in an industry that has high chances for lead exposure.
And Josh, how aware are families in these affected communities, Fresno, for example, how aware are they of this issue?
Well, there has been some written, including by the Fresno Bee, about substandard housing and lead exposure in Fresno. And the lead poisoning prevention program there says that it tries to do outreach across the city and educate families. But without more specific data, like the stuff that we've been publishing and like the stuff that we'd like to receive more of from California, it is hard for a community to assess the risks in its own backyard. You know, if you look across the state, the rate is maybe 2% of children who are tested and who show high blood lead levels. But of course, if you pinpoint communities where the risks are much higher, you see exponentially higher rates. So those are hot spots, and communities should know when they live in a hot spot.
And you have a map that is associated with your story. If we Google your story, you can look at the map and see where those hotspots are, right?
Yeah, we're really proud of the map. We included data from dozens of states, including California. And what it allows a reader or user to do is just look at their own neighborhood and see the prevalence of lead poisoning among children tested there. You can even enter an address if you want and kind of go from there. And you can look all over the country.
Josh Schneer and Michael Pell, investigative reporters for Reuters, and you can check out their story at Reuters.com. Thank you both very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about lead poisoning in your neighborhood? You can let us know on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. You can also find a link to that Reuters map there. Places where there are high lead levels around the state. And you can see if your neighborhood is on the map. Coming up, imagine having amnesia. You can't remember your best friends or the person you met 5 minutes ago, but maybe your condition will at least help other people.
We can't predict in exactly what ways this basic research on memory could someday help other people, but the more we know about memory and how it works in the brain, the more likely it is that we will find those remedies.
How one woman is advancing neuroscience, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. One day, about 10 years ago, while she was puttering around her farmhouse in upstate New York, Lonnie Sue Johnson felt funny. She became disoriented, then she collapsed. She was rushed to the emergency room. But when she woke up, she didn't recognize anyone, not the friend who brought her there, not her sister. Lonnie Sue had suffered from an acute case of encephalitis brought on by the herpes virus, which attacked her brain and gave her permanent amnesia. Her story and why her amnesia may not be such a tragedy after all is the subject of a new book called Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. It's written by Michael Lemonick, who's here now. Welcome.
Thanks.
Well, you knew Lonnie Sue's sister from way back when you were younger, and when you ran into her, the sister, many years later, she told you what had happened to Lonnie Sue. What was she like before the amnesia? What was her life like? What were her accomplishments?
So as you say, I knew the sister a little bit. I did not know Lonnie Sue at all, although we were also in high school together. So I had to reconstruct her life by talking to her sister and her mother and many of her friends. And what her life was like was extremely successful. She was very, very talented. She was an artist, a commercial artist who did covers for the New Yorker magazine, had many, many journalistic clients and corporate clients. She was also an extremely talented amateur musician who would sit in with the Princeton University Orchestra when she was still in high school. She played the viola. And she was a private pilot, which is a pretty tough skill to master, especially since she had her own landing strip on a field next to her house. So it was, she had to be a very good pilot. And she was a small businesswoman. She was just extremely focused and worked all the time and was very, very accomplished.
Amazing. So she was an extraordinary woman before this happened. What, if any, of those skills remained after the amnesia?
Well, so she was able to pick up the viola again, play it. She was able to read music after she recovered from the acute infection, that is. She was basically unable to walk or talk at first. She began drawing again after about a year, and her art came back in a kind of an odd, quirky, twisted way that had some of the characteristics of what she'd done before but was very different. And we don't know if she could fly a plane, but nobody's going to let her try.
Right. Well, tell more about the art and how that changed.
Well, so her mother, Maggie Johnson, who was 90 years old when this happened and who died just in 2015 at the age of 97, was one of her primary caretakers along with her sister, Aline. And Maggie was her first art teacher. She was an artist herself. And as her daughter recovered, she and Aline were determined that Lonnie Sue would regain as many of her abilities as they could help her do. Lonnie Sue wasn't very motivated to do this, but eventually she began drawing again. And her art was focused, instead of on images, purely on images, was focused on word puzzles, which she became almost obsessed with. The thinking is that the alphabet is so deeply ingrained in our memory, you don't have to think about it when you repeat the alphabet. It gave her something to hang on to, a structure to hang on to. And so she started devising word puzzles, word search puzzles, the kind where there's a grid of seemingly nonsensical letters, but there are words hidden there, and you find them and you circle them. So she started creating her own word puzzles, and then she began illustrating them. And her art now consists of these word puzzles that have these beautiful, beautiful illustrations as part of them, but not as the main focus.
So she knew how to draw still. She knew that's part of the brain that wasn't affected by the virus, that she could, these old skills that she had that were ingrained in her, she could bring back, the art and and playing the viola.
Right. And that's sort of key, that you described them as skills, or that's partially key, because we've known since the early 50s that even when the memory-forming apparatus in the brain is destroyed by encephalitis or by surgery or by head injury, other sort of skills that we think of, we use the term muscle memory, riding a bike, playing the viola, which is very much involved with muscle memory, and drawing, it turns out, although nobody really knew that before. Those are retained even though the victim has lost all memories of events and of facts about the world. So the drawing came back, and it was kind of remarkable, partly because it was not only the skill of drawing, but the ability to describe in great detail how you go about making a watercolor, for example. That was something that really surprised neuroscientists. They'd never had a subject like this to work with, somebody who had this kind of skill, and they assumed that kind of knowledge, again, of facts, you know, you wet the brush and you mix the paint and you do this and you do that. And she could describe these things in great, great detail, which really astonished the scientists, especially because when they showed her 20 old master paintings, you know, things you and I would recognize, she could only recognize one or two of them. So a drastic lack in certain kinds of knowledge, but a retention of others.
Would she recognize her own paintings?
Well, that's a good point. So they showed her these old masters, Michelangelo and Raphael, I don't know. But she majored in art history, mm-hmm. right? So she should have known these. All she could recognize was maybe the Mona Lisa and the Last Supper. But when they showed her a group of paintings, artworks, some of which were hers, she could always pick out her own. So she recognized her own style somehow. And nobody, again, knows how this is possible.
And yet she didn't recognize people whom she knew for a long time.
Oh, yeah, so her dearest friends. So she'd lived in Cooperstown, New York, for about a decade before this happened. This is where she had the landing strip next to her house. She lived on a farm. And she made very, very deep friendships, which she characteristically did throughout her life. She was very... people were very attracted to her as a person and really felt warm and close to her. And people who had been among her dearest friends, one woman who would come over every week or so and they'd take long walks through the fields and talk about art and music and life. They'd been planning to work on a book together. She never recognized this woman again, nor any of her close friends from Cooperstown, nor most of her childhood friends, nor most of her friends that she made when she was in New York for 10 or 15 years. All of that was gone.
And she didn't remember that her father had died.
Right. So something even as fundamental as that. I actually watched a video that her sister had made when Lonnie Sue was still in a rehab center. And she's talking and suddenly she looks around. She sees her mother. She sees her sister. She says, "Where's Daddy?" And Aline says, "He died." And Lonnie Sue is devastated. "He died. Why didn't I know this? When did this happen?" And they explain to her it happened about 20 years ago. She calms down a little bit. And then within a minute, she looks around and says, "Well, where's Daddy?" And they have to go through the whole thing again. And she's devastated all over again. This is in the space of a few minutes. And so even something as deep and profound as that experience of losing her father, whom she was close to, was gone, was just gone. She doesn't know that she'd been married for a decade. She doesn't know almost anything about her past, except for general facts.
So often when you talk about, when we talk about people aging and losing their memory, we find that they can't remember things that they did yesterday or right. an hour ago, but they can remember something from 30 years ago.
Yes, or 50 years ago, and they can remember it very vividly. She can't do that. And the most appalling thing of all in some ways is that she can almost not at all form new memories to carry with her into the future. So just as with her father, her father's death, if you meet her and then you go out of the room for 5 minutes and come back, she'll have no idea she ever saw you before. And if you go out again and come back, it's the same thing all over, over and over again.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Michael Lemonick about his new book. It's called The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. And while you talk about the tragedy of her not being able to remember what has just happened, and I guess that's really to learn, I suppose, she does mm-hmm. make some progress. I mean, she is able to form some kind of memory or at least remember things that initially she couldn't remember.
Right. So another thing we've known for more than 50 years from the very first victim of this kind of brain injury in the literature, a guy named Henry Mollison from 1953, people with this kind of brain damage can actually form new memories, but only after repetition, after repetition, after repetition, 100 repetitions, they might be able to grasp a new fact. So Lonnie Sue now does remember that her father died because her mother and sister repeated that hundreds and hundreds of times, and finally she grasps it. And the same is true for just a small handful of facts about her past and about her present experience. So she also knows, finally, that her mother died in 2015, which is good because, I mean, having her go through that tragic rediscovery over and over again was just heart-wrenching to watch.
Yeah. And also you write that it has a lot to do with her family and the way her family was completely involved in her life and in her recovery. Her mother and her sister, they cared for her daily. She has this positive attitude. And there's something there, too, in terms of the social connection and her ability to recover somewhat.
Yes. So when I heard about how carefully and relentlessly her mother and sister cared for her, but also pushed her to learn to walk and to learn to talk and to learn to draw again and to pick up the viola. If she had been left to the devices of even a very good set of rehab specialists who would see her once or twice a day for a half hour and who didn't know her whole history, I think she would be in much, much worse shape today than she actually is. But the other thing that you alluded to, and this is something I was very impressed by through the process of reporting this book, was how her essential personality, as people had described it before the illness, was preserved. So when I first started working on this book, my assumption was that if you lose your memories, you lose your sense of self. You don't know who you are, because who we are is based on our experiences, all the things that have molded us into what we are now. And if you lose access to those, I mean, who are you? So the working title of the book was originally The Woman Who Lost Herself. And after doing all the reporting, I had to change the title because it is clear that the essence of who she is, her personality, her cheerfulness, her ability to draw people to her is absolutely unchanged. I've sat in on a number of testing sessions by neuroscientists who are trying to probe the limits of what she still can do and what she can't do. And at almost every session, they have to stop the testing because she says something so funny, they all crack up and laugh together. I mean, I never imagined neuroscientific research could be like this, but the scientists developed an enormous affection for her. And that's all part of the recovery process. And so, you know, she has lost the memories, most of the memories, but she has her sister now that her mother has died, to keep reminding her of who she was. And she also has this spirit that is just impossible to beat down, even with a massive, massive brain injury. So, as you said earlier, it may be, I mean, it's still a tragedy, obviously. She can't live independently. She can't do many of the things she used to do. She can't fly a plane, and she misses that, or at least she says she misses that. But who she is absolutely preserved. And I was just amazed by it.
So is there some hope that studying Lonnie Sue could yield some clues into curing Alzheimer's or treating it?
Sure. And in fact, one of the ways that her mother and sister have convinced her to participate in these studies, because she has to be a willing participant, otherwise they wouldn't go ahead, is to impress on her that these studies could someday help other people. And that's one of those other facts that she has heard 100 or 200 times and now has retained. And it's true in the sense that basic scientific research is almost always useful in some way in the future in ways we can't predict. So they're not studying specifically with her how to restore memory. But the more we understand basically about how memory works, just like the more we understand about how special relativity works, eventually that became useful in GPS satellites, where in timing the signals back and forth. So we can't predict in exactly what ways this basic research on memory could someday help other people. But the more we know about memory and how it works in the brain, the more likely it is that we will find those remedies. So it's a little distant, but it's absolutely related.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It was fascinating.
Well, good. My pleasure.
That's Michael Lemonick. He's the author of the new book, The Perpetual Now, A Story of Amnesia, Memory, and Love. Los Angeles has so much water, the mayor is now warning of flooding in Owens Lake when the Sierra snow melts. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA Mayor Eric Garcetti declared a state of emergency this week. He's concerned that melting snowpack in the Sierra Nevada could cause flooding at Owens Lake and damage the LA Aqueduct. The aqueduct supplies more than half of the water in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, some of that excess water will be used to refill the Silver Lake Reservoir ahead of schedule. Richard Harrisick is a senior water manager at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Welcome.
Hello.
So Owens Lake is about 200 miles from Los Angeles, and until recently, it was pretty dry. In fact, we were sending water back up there to tamp down the dust. What does it look like right now?
The lake itself is 110 square miles, and we have to cover about 50 of that. 30 of it in the center is what's called the Owens Lake brine pool. And right now, water is flowing down the Owens River into Owens Lake, and the level of that brine pool is rising, and we anticipate it may rise up to 7 more feet. And the negative part about that is that it's going to push those floodwaters into that infrastructure that we've built since 2001 to control the dust, and may severely damage that. So we've put in about $1 billion worth of capital infrastructure on the lake in the form of berms and roads and water piping networks and pump stations and the like. And those facilities, a good portion of them, may get damaged.
Wow. $1 billion worth of infrastructure damaged?
Correct. Well, that's how much we put in, and hopefully we're going to limit that. We don't anticipate it all being damaged, but to the tune of maybe several hundred million dollars worth, yes.
Okay. So what are you doing to try to prevent that?
You know, we have 2.5 amount of the amount of snow we normally have for this time of year, and that's projected to run off 1 million acre feet. So 1 million acre feet is a big number. In fact, it's twice the amount that the city consumed last year in total. So we can only bring actually about 500,000, a half of that, down into the city through our aqueduct system. We're just limited. And so that leaves a half a million acre feet up in the Owens Valley. Now, we have regular obligations up there to mitigate the environment from our because of our activities, as well as we supply water to our ranch lessees up there. And we're going to do that. And then there's a good extra amount that we're going to just spread out into the Owens Valley, and it'll get soaked up into the groundwater table there and raise that. And we can use that later. But that's going to leave still upwards of 200,000 acre feet that's going to flow down the river into the lake and do the damage that we talked about. It's hard to stop that amount of water from doing damage. So we're going to try to control it as it enters into Owens Lake from not damaging facilities. So we may do some armoring with rocks and boulders, and we may channelize that water to direct it to an area and in a way that it won't do any further damage. But it's impossible to stop the rise of that level of water in the lake. So we do anticipate that we're going to suffer some damage.
Are you worried at all that it could flood the neighboring community?
Generally, what you will probably see is not necessarily damage in the towns, but probably to roads and open, bare areas within the Owens Valley, just collecting water and water being channelized down and with high flows.
Now, what about the aqueduct itself? Is there any worry at all that we could be seeing an Oroville spillway situation, the crumbling of part
sure.
of it that we saw up north a little while ago?
Right. We do have a number of reservoirs, four significant reservoirs up in the Owens Valley. And we are lowering the amount of water that's in there in anticipation of capturing a lot of water when it starts running off. All of our reservoirs combined equal only 7% of what Oroville holds. So that shows you either how big Oroville is or how small ours is. So we don't anticipate the dramatic rushing of water over the spillway there. We may see short bursts of that, maybe a day or two. That's what we're trying to hold that to. But we don't anticipate that kind of dramatic spilling over our reservoirs.
But could that happen?
Theoretically could happen. And it really is, we're dealing with two things. We're dealing with the volume of water and the rate that it runs off. So if there was a persistent hot spell here in the spring that caused an earlier and higher flow runoff, then you may see some of that. But that's why we're building that, what we call a hole in the reservoir. And what I mean by that is lowering the water so there's a big pocket there to capture that runoff. So we're doing everything we can to manage the system to take as much water as we can when it comes.
Okay, so let's talk about the Silver Lake Reservoir. So
sure.
You're going to fill that up? Are you going to fill it up to the brim now? Because earlier the plans were just to fill it up partially.
Right. So we're going to fill it up in the higher end of the historic range because we have an abundance of water. We really have twice as much as what the city can consume. So we're actually looking for ways to put that water to beneficial use. And really, it's a direct connection to keeping that water out of Owens Lake. Owens Lake is basically the Pacific Ocean, if you will, of the Owens Valley. It's where all the water ends up there. So any water that we can bring down to L.A., won't go into Owens Lake. So we're looking for different ways to fill those up. So Silver Lake will be filled, and a number of the other reservoirs that are out of service will also be filled up. And when I say Silver Lake, it's important that we say Silver Lake and Ivanhoe.
Mm-hmm. The two. Yeah, they're right next to each other.
Right.
But how do you get it in there? Do you have the infrastructure? Do you have the pipes?
Yeah, it'll just be through the normal distribution system that we have within the city.
So it's already there?
Correct.
So this is not water you can drink. This is just...
This will be drinking water, potable water that we'll be putting in there. But again, it either ends up in the Pacific Ocean someplace or it ends up in Owens Lake. So it's an overall beneficial use to the city.
But no one's going to be drinking that water.
No, that reservoir is out of service because of the federal rules that have taken that out of service. But it's there for an emergency use for nothing less than firefighting protection.
And so you're going to start filling it up when, next month?
Mid-April.
And when will that be completed?
I think the filling's going to be within a month or two.
So is everyone happy about that? The residents were complaining that there was this big empty pit in the middle of their neighborhood.
Right. It's not so much you can call yourself Silver Lake without a lake.
Yeah.
So they needed that. We actually had a public meeting last night, and it was received very well. Both Councilman Ryu and O'Farrell were there to kind of help celebrate that with us.
Richard Harrisick, Senior Water Manager at the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And Julie Myers is here to round out the show. Hi there.
Hello. And the Adam Schiff fan club weighed in today. This is the man that the New York Times has called more labradoodle than attack dog. Mike DiPolo agrees. He says Schiff is the consummate professional when he is grilling people. He doesn't overplay his hand or overdo the outrage. I am highly impressed with how serious and effective he has been handling the whole Russia affair. Other opinions, welcome. KCRW Press Play.
All right. Thank you, Julie Myers, and thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.